check the sound is all right. You can let me know at the back. Okay, I think that was an okay. Yeah. So maybe to try something a little bit different this evening. Sometimes we just give a talk and maybe like nobody knows quite where it's going. And that can be okay. But, you know, there was, I've reflected for some time and people have asked me, you know, around this idea. It's like, why do we teach in this way? I think it's worth asking this question. Like, why do we have in the evening about 45 minutes of one person talking? Is that the best way of transferring knowledge, wisdom, teachings, anything like that? I think, you know, could be a good question to ask. Particularly, I'm sure some of you work in education, actually understand how, you know, teachings actually work really well and what teaching methods don't work really well. And probably a 45-minute monologue isn't in the top 10, you know. So why are we still doing this? Maintaining a tradition, 2,500 years of failing to get the message across. So maybe it's helpful if I tell you right away what this talk is about, you know, a little bit of structure, and then you'll recognize the signposts when we go past them again later on. Yeah. So the main idea to begin with is that we're going to get rid of dukkha. Yeah. Okay, so remember that. That's what this whole talk is about. Yeah. So if it starts to drift away from there, you can remember. Okay, it's going to come back to there at some point. What we're going to look at today is a sense of, in life at times, yeah, we kind of make a fist out of in the way that we relate to things. Yeah, like grab onto them and try and punch them away. Yeah, it's that kind of fist way of living. Yeah. And that's dukkha, yeah, for sure that's dukkha, right? But perhaps what we're tasting here is the sense that we can actually open that fist. And the hand is so much more useful that way, right? It's like, it'd be foolish to think you could fix everything with a fist, yeah. But sometimes we live like that, yeah. Either it's the fist that grabs onto things or the fist that, you know, hits it away. Yeah. So we could say, freedom from dukkha might look like living with an open palm, an open hand. All that sensitivity available to connect with what we make contact with. Yeah. The other element that I want to explore through the talk, right, okay, so the whole talk is about freedom from dukkha, that fist, open palm expression. Also, what happens to how we sense ourself through that process. Yeah, what happens to how we sense who we are through that opening, through moving from dukkha to freedom? Now, what actually happens there? And the reason I want to talk about it is because I think there are many dials on our experience. Yeah, I noticed as we went to get the plates today, you know, someone's written up there. Maybe you also noticed because you're really hyper aware. Something like moving from, was it papancha and pain or to freedom? Yeah, so just can we move that dial a little bit? So there's not one dial. There's not one dial. And so that's also what this talk is about. There are many, many dials, yeah, that we can play with. But they're all connected. They're all connected. Okay, so that's the short version. You can tweet about it. This is the slightly longer post for those who got drawn in. Yeah. All practices, all Dharma practices are ways of deconstructing dukkha. Yeah. Ways of developing, cultivating freedom. We spoke about in the Q&A today, opening the space between stimuli and response. We could say, getting more flexibility, possibilities between contacting something and reacting to something. Yeah. Particularly, I think, see that in the Vedana practice today. Yeah. That's such an opportunity to say, oh, that's pleasant, let's just enjoy it. Yeah, let's not try and get more of it, let's not try and make it last, let's actually just enjoy it. And oftentimes that feels more enjoyable. Yeah. Or something comes, it's not exactly what we want, but we don't fight against it, don't push against it, just kind of soften, let it go through, let it go through. And sometimes we can notice, oh, it actually passed more easily. It was actually less troubling, less painful, less difficult, because of the way that I met it. Yeah. So we say, open that space between stimuli and response, and fill that space with wisdom, with kindness, with compassion, with calm. Yeah. And even with our particular intentions, values, what brings meaningfulness, what brings beauty to our life. Yeah. So it can, there's also room for your personal way that you want to be. Yeah. So we open that space, there's the freedom in that framework to also be yourself, be what you value, to practice your way. Yeah. So on this retreat, pretty much like any other, yeah, practices that are deconstructing dukkha, even mindfulness really liberates us from quite a lot of the dukkha in our experience. Yeah. So mindfulness, this being present with what's unfolding. Yeah. Being open to the peacock calls, the rising, falling experience, it kind of opens us to that wave-like nature, just paying attention to life. To, oh yeah, and then it passes through and it's, something opens, something releases in that moment of being present. You know, when you're with people and there's a lot going on, you'll notice at times they actually get distracted. You know, that you're talking to someone, you're being with someone, that you've got their attention, and then you suddenly notice that, oh, they're starting to think about something else, you know. And that happens to us a lot in our meditations, and it's like, I'm paying attention to the breath, or I'm listening to the sounds, or I'm practicing the metta, or I'm noticing the Veda, and so I drift away. Yeah. They say, oh, well, I've drifted away, and then you come back again. And the word in English for this is to be distracted. Someone's distracted, they're not with us. And I like etymology, you know, the roots of words. And I think Hebrew is a really good language for that, isn't it? Like, it's a very rich etymology. You can look into all the words that we use and like, oh, where do they come from? Why are we using that word? And I think it's beautiful that languages have that. And you can play the same game with English, and has it's adopted a lot of things from different places. So the word distract means dis is apart, to go apart from something. And the tract is the draw. So it's like to be drawn away. Or to, in fact, it's to be drawn apart. It's to be drawn apart. And so some would say, you know, the opposite of being distracted all the time is to be concentrated. And that's quite nice, concentrated, if we really understand what it means to be with the center, to be centered, to be with the whole center of the being and whatever we feel that to be, yeah, the real life force of this being, to be in that state. I think the more easy to understand word is to be gathered. Now we're pulled apart or we're gathered back together. Yeah. And so that whole sense of being gathered back together is also, you know, an expression of not dukkha, to be gathered together. And so being mindful, being present, being willing to come back and be gathered, yeah, is part of that. Part of this gathering is also to understand that each of us is actually a community. Yeah, each of us is actually a community. We're not a one thing, you know. And so when we have that sense of being gathered, it's like, yeah, all of us is welcome. All of us is welcome. So we say, everyone here is welcome. And we say, all of us are welcome. And also individually, yeah, all of us is welcome. Yeah. It's not like you have to check your bad mood or your bad smell or your, you know, achy bodies at the door and come in. Try and be pure beings in here if you can. You know, all of us is welcome. Yeah. I remember one teacher, maybe they were repeating some kind of old traditional thing, is they actually say, you know, everyone is welcome through the gates of the Dharma. It's like very, very big gate. So all of us can come in. And there are many places in our life where we actually don't allow all of us to be here. Yeah. All of us to have a place. Yeah. Some parts get cut off. And so we talk about, you know, wholesomeness in the practice. And that whole, the whole of the wholesomeness, yeah. Like sometimes we say, oh, really wholesome stuff is that I have to cut off certain behaviors that I used to do, you know, to be wholesome. That idea of wholesomeness that is excluding something else. And kind of question that a little bit. Question that in terms of a sense of community. And other ways that we practice is to be less contracted, you know, less tight. Something we've been working with through the practices, also that capacity we have to maybe like breathe deeper, listen wider, opening the space allows for more to unfold. Yeah. And that's also another way that we can include more, allow for more expressions of how we are. And I don't know if you feel this quality as well. It's like when there's more space, also coming with that is more sensitivity. It's like there can be more gentleness with what appears. We can be more in contact, more intimacy, perhaps, we could say, yeah, in our experience. And all of that are expressions of less dukkha. Yeah? And we're moving from that clenched position to that more kind of open hand, able to be with, able to meet. Yeah? And as always, we're just talking about turning the dial a little bit. Yeah, so it could just be that it opens a little bit. Yeah. We have a sense of the direction we're going in, and we just do a little bit. If that's nice, we can do a little bit more. If it's not nice, you don't have to do any more. You can come back. It's your metaphorical hand. And you'll probably also notice that, you know, sometimes because we're practicing metta, more kindness starts to come into being. But also, it's also just a natural expression of less dukkha, more kindness. It just seems to kind of unfold that way. And with that openness, with that sensitivity, we're more able to open to our experience. And when we're more open to our experience, we can actually understand our experience a little bit better. Yeah, we're not as confused about our experience. You're open, you're sensitive, things arise, and they pass. It's like, oh, anicca is very, very obvious, yeah, in this experience. The other insights that arise, it's like, okay, being tight, being contracted, being controlling, being all of this, it's dukkha, it's not so pleasant. And the really important insight underlying everything is there's always the possibility to do something. It's always the possibility to do something. But it doesn't always appear to us that there's something that we can do. So we have to be quiet. We have to listen. We have to remember the possibility of possibilities. Yeah, even if we can't see what's possible, we know that some possibility that there is some possibility eventually is there. You know, it's the smallest thing that starts to open, expand what we can do. So we speak a lot about dukkha, the absence of freedom, in these teachings which are really interested in freedom. Not just because, you know, the Buddha and everyone who's followed in his footsteps has got this really strong negativity bias and they like to talk about what's not so good in our experience. But because it's a really helpful framework to just kind of, what can we tune into in our direct experience now? That is perhaps limiting our freedom, yeah, that we indulge in distraction. Yeah. I know you did. You did, didn't you? You indulged in the distraction today. It came up and you went with it. You knew you should have come back, but you didn't. Okay? Don't do that tomorrow. At times we allowed ourselves to remain contracted, you know, self-obsessed for a little bit longer than was really helpful. And we often perhaps went off into intellectual, what do you call this? Like, I know the word conjecture, but that's not very helpful. Like intellectual fantasies about, you know, oh, and if this is this, and how is this, and, you know, the ideas world, and we kind of go off into there. And the Buddha would often pull back people from their kind of fantastical ideas and just like, what about the dukkha that's manifesting now? You could get rid of that. Like, you realize it's conditioned. It's conditioned. And this is where he comes in with his, you know, Four Noble Truths teaching, you know, is that this second noble truth, to understand that dukkha is conditioned. It's conditioned. And I think that's a really helpful word. Did you hear the difference between there is a cause for dukkha and that dukkha is conditioned? And, like, it's not always obvious, and it may not be obvious in the language. But let's say, for example, the cause, we could say, well, let's take this example of this microphone. I know Zara sang the praises of this microphone yesterday. I'm happy to sing its praises also. I won't sing, but I'll express my appreciation for its sound. So we could say, my voice sounds better in this hall, and the cause for that is this microphone. Yeah? And... well, no, it's not the only thing that's going on, you know. The speakers, the actual tone of my voice, all of these things are also factors in here, yeah. So if we said, maybe instead of talking about the quality of my voice, let's actually talk about that you can hear me, yeah. The reason you can hear me is because this microphone is good, yeah. But actually all this microphone is doing is picking up the sound and being played through here. Like, if we didn't have this box, you wouldn't hear anything, you know? So is the microphone the cause for hearing the sound? No, but it's a condition. It's a condition for that. If we didn't have the microphone, the whole thing wouldn't work. But there are many other things here as well. It's like if we didn't have the speakers, if we didn't have electricity, if sound waves didn't move through the air, you know, it's like there's a lot of conditions happening here. And we say, oh, you can hear me because the microphone's so good. And we can really focus in on that and get obsessed around that. And it's like, yeah, and if we get a better microphone, it'll sound even better, you know. And this could go on. I'm sure that wouldn't happen to any of us, but you could imagine how it could happen to someone less wise. And so if we hear a teaching that says, what is the cause for dukkha? What is the cause for dukkha? And it's like, there's loads of stuff. There's loads of stuff. But what's the condition for dukkha is a really skillful question, okay? And it's the same question. It's like, what are the dials? It's an invitation. It's like, what are the dials that we could adjust that would actually reduce dukkha? Yeah. So the way that the Dharma is sometimes taught, and it's great that it's taught this way, I'm not criticizing it and saying, you know, what's the cause of dukkha? The cause of dukkha is tanha. Tanha is craving or something like this, yeah? So you probably come across a teaching that would express it that way. And, you know, I'm quite into accuracy, so I would say it's not really true, you know. But it's actually that I think the Buddha was actually asking us a really big question. And maybe an accurate way of saying it is like, what are the conditions for dukkha? What are the conditions for dukkha? Another way of saying that, or a simpler way of saying that, is when there's dukkha, what else is there? What else is going on? Yeah. And then there could be like quite a list. Like, it's not just craving. There's like, how do we feel the craving? There's that tightness, yeah? The clenched fist feeling of our experience, yeah? There's that time pressure that builds up. There's that really kind of important sense of a something that either has to happen, I have to get it, get rid of it, you know. There's an inflated sense of the solidity of that. It doesn't appear like a wave, it really appears like a thing, and if I get it or get rid of it, then yeah, oh, it's going to be such a relief for everyone. And with that, also this inflated sense of self, because it's this self here that has to do that activity. Yeah, I've got a job to do, I've got a thing to fix, yeah, I've got a short amount of time in which to do it, I'm tight and I'm focused and I'm going to go ahead. And you say, yeah, all of that are conditions of dukkha. What if we changed any one of them? Yeah. So let's just take like the sense of time, the time pressure. It's got to happen now. And we say, well, it could happen any time. You say, open that, it's like, oh, that thing softens down, the self softens down. Yeah. The contraction opens out, all of that. It's like, oh, so that was the cause of the dukkha. It can really appear that way. But no, it was one of the conditions. But all those dials are connected. The same one is like, if you say, let's just open the contraction. It's like, can you be contracted? I mean, uncontracted. Can you be loose? Can you be spacious? And still really have a big sense of self and a demand and a thing and the rashes. And like, no, I'm really relaxed. Like, they've given me a really good sedative. And I'm just, it's dukkha. I can't manifest it. Yeah? So you get to see, all of these teachings, they're not saying this is the problem. They're saying this is the dial. Can you play? Can you adjust it? You know, can you dance with that? Yeah. So I don't know if you have this sense, you know, that you need to kill your ego so that you can, you know, kind of get free, or you have to lose your sense of self and identity or whatever else, you know, that kind of sensibility that can kind of come into our practice at times. It's like, I have to stop being me. You know, they said everyone's welcome within, into the gates of the Dharma, but it's not that everyone gets to leave. You've got to take off your self and then you'll be free. Yeah, this kind of thing. But I think actually it's just another dial, right? It's another dial. There can be a problematic, built up, self-centered, self-obsessed experience. And what do we experience in the meditation when it's really nice? It's really nice. That self sense really just goes quiet. Yeah. Doesn't disappear completely, you know, or not immediately. It's like, oh, what a relief. Not playing that part so much. And so we're not against the self, yeah. But the self sense is a dial that we can play with. So, maybe I take this lighter. Yeah. And so if we make the self the enemy of dukkha, that's actually turning the dial up, right? You see, it's actually giving the self the job of getting rid of the self. It's really hard to hire a self to kill the self, but it's always ready to do it. It's like, yeah, I'm going to get rid of myself. But I'm feeling a lot of dukkha about it, kind of unsure. But yeah, I understand that's what I have to do, and that's what I'm going to do. So, no, I think just need to allow it to quieten down. So, what actually are the experiences where the self-sense quietens down, where the demanding quietens down, where the time sense opens out, where all of this happens? Yeah. So many of you may know that the Buddha talks about craving and clinging. Clinging and craving. Do you hear these words at times? Yeah. So tanha, literally it means thirst. We often translate it as craving. Yeah. I like to use the word demanding because it kind of works for me. Is that when you're really demanding about something? So I demand to have this. I demand to get rid of that. You know, I'm not negotiating. I've made a demand. And if it doesn't happen, I will give myself dukkha. And so they come up together. Yeah. And if I decide, actually, I'm going to drop my demands, you know, and it's like, oh, and also kind of dukkha fades away. The building up of the demanding builds up in this quality called upadana, that sometimes we call clinging. And some people describe it as it's like demanding, but with even more like self-importance involved in it. Yeah, there's even more selfing, got to get it in that thing. But upadana is another of these words that actually has a really beautiful etymology, like a really beautiful, how is this word structured? So have you all heard of the word dana? Yeah? It's like paying our wages? No, it's the spirit of generosity that supports these teachings. Yeah, these beautiful teachings were given to the world to help beings of the world become more free. Now, what a beautiful gift to give. And passed on, and people got a handle on them, practiced them, learned how to do them, and then passed them on to others. And so they will continuously be passed on for free until someone thinks, you know, I could package that up in a slightly different thing, give it a different name, and I could sell it for millions. And then perhaps they'll do that occasionally. But like generally, it's still going to be passed on by people who aren't that well off, and they'll share it with others who maybe aren't that well off, and we make sure that everybody has access to freedom teachings. Why? Because they're priceless. Because learning how to turn the dials of our experience to get more free is priceless. And why would you hold that back from anyone? Of course you wouldn't. Of course you wouldn't. You wouldn't try and put a price tag on something that's priceless. We're not that stupid. Well, some of us are not that stupid. Most of us aren't, yeah. So dana is what is freely offered. As freely as the trees are making this oxygen that we're sucking in, and we give back out the carbon dioxide that they turn into their bodies. Yeah, it's just that free exchange of things. Yeah. So, adana means not dana. Okay, adana means not dana. Adukkha means not dukkha. Yeah. So the a prefix of a word means it is not. So it's undana, non-dana, however we'd say that. Yeah. Upadana, then, is this word that we're using for clinging. Yeah, and up actually is kind of similar to what we use in English, like turn up. So we've taken the dial of dana, and we've turned it into the negative. It's now working as not generosity, not freely given. And then we're going to oop it up to 11, yeah? So it's upadana, really complete absence of generosity. And what does that look like? The clenched fist. And so these freedom teachings are speaking about opening the clenched fist in the mind, opening the clenched fist in the heart, opening the clenched fist in the body, yeah? So how do we do that? How do we do that? We do that through all the ways that we've already been practicing. But that's what we get to understand, is that this is the liberation that we're talking about. Yeah, it's finding that capacity to get onto the upadana dial and just, yeah, turn it way, 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 way down. And we can do that through opening the body, calming the time pressure rush, letting us see the things that we pay attention to as waves and gentle arisings and passings that we don't need to make such a big fuss about. Yeah. Softening that sense of self. Yeah. Letting things be. Switching from demanding to kindness. Welcoming, allowing, supporting. Not taking the Vedana as a fact. Vedana is a fact, it leads to all kinds of trouble. And today we practice, we'd like to say, oh yeah, there's that. I don't know if, so I'll use the word opinion. Yeah. But I like to say that, you know, that Vedana is an opinion, you know. There's that lovely line in the film, do you know the film The Big Lebowski? And there's a scene where some guy comes and he really criticizes the hippie guy in The Big Lebowski, and he says, at the end of it, you know, end of this really long thing, he said, that's your opinion, dude. It's just your opinion. And just seeing the Vedana, that's so nice, you've got to get it. Get more of it. You know, it's so delicious, I should have more on my plate. Whatever it is, it's just an opinion. Just an opinion. That really softens that demanding. So, what I'd like us to have the sense of is when we think that dukkha is conditioned, dukkha is conditioned, and we open out that there are many, many dials that we can adjust in this experience. So using the ones that work for you, using the ones that work for you. But interestingly enough, there's one that sounds like it really wouldn't work. Yeah, it sounds like it's quite negative. But it can be just the thing for some of us. Yeah, and that doesn't mean that you're a negative person. It means that maybe you've got a good enough sense of humor. I'm hearing like you're laughing quite a lot at things that aren't even very funny, so you must be in a good mood. So let's try this one. Yeah. So we could go direct to the experience of things, yeah. So, you know how, actually Czar gives this good example, that they did a study about some people who went shopping, and they went and they were given a credit card, I think, and they were said, you know, you can go into this shop and you can buy anything you like. So have a look around, see what you like. You can pick this thing off the shelf, just go there, pay with your credit card. The only thing we want to know is we want to put some, what do they call those things? So what, they put electrodes on them? Yeah, okay, so they put like these sensors, these electrodes on them so that they can kind of measure their mood. Is that right? Yeah. Because they want to know at what point is the peak happiness? Yeah. And so you get to kind of predict, where do you think peak happiness comes? So there could be like seeing the thing, taking it off, holding it, saying, yeah, it's this one. Or is it when you pay for it? Is it when you get it home and you put it on for the first time? Or, you know, what do you think? Where's peak happiness happen in the whole experience? Or somewhere else, maybe, somewhere I haven't mentioned. Does anyone know? Where do you think it would be? Huh? Giving it away to someone else. Yeah. At the moment they were given the credit card before going into the shop and seeing anything. Like, I'm going to get something that moment. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a good one. Yeah. I don't know if they already had the electrodes on them at that point, but it might be. Yeah, they should have. Yeah. That's a good guess. Yeah. When they want it, when they fantasize it about like having it before they've even own it, yeah. These are really good guesses. I think it's when they pay. Yeah, I think it's maybe the moment just before they pay.
They hand the credit card over.
Uh-huh. So they're handing the credit card over.
But they haven't gotten the thing yet. The cashier still has the thing.
Yeah. So they measured it as the moment of just about to pay and about to receive, you know. And interestingly, this actually correlates with what the Buddha was predicting, was actually what's going on in this experience, okay? Because it's the demanding to have the thing that is supporting the dukkha. Getting the thing, it no longer makes sense to demand for it, right? It's like, yeah, it's coming to me. They've got the credit card. I know the credit card works because they've just given it to me, and I'm going to get the thing. Demanding goes down, happiness flushes up. But did you know there's no happiness sewn into dresses and shirts and also houses and other people and roles, and none of these things actually contain any happiness. You can check the ingredients yourself, you know, of all kinds of foods. So where's happiness come from? Where does happiness come from? Well, who brought the happiness into the shop? Yeah? It was obviously the shopper. They brought in their own happiness, and then they unleashed it at the moment where they thought they were going to get something. Okay? Happiness comes from within, dude. Comes from within. So we're bringing our own happiness, and we release happiness by dropping the demand. So the Buddha says, well, let's not go shopping. Let's just drop the demand and unleash the happiness. Okay? So in the Dharma, the Buddha is often saying this quote, or he's often quoted as saying, what, when I do it, will lead to my long-term well-being and happiness? What, when I do it, will lead to my long-term well-being and happiness? Yeah? I think some of you are getting distracted. I can feel it. I can feel it. Yeah? But that's an important line, so you'll just have to remember what it was. What was it? Anyway, it doesn't matter. So it's an invitation to an action. Do you notice that? It's what when I do it. It's not something else. Yeah, it's a karma. There's an action. There's an activity there. And that what when I do it is dropping the demand. And that leads to my long-term well-being and happiness. Yeah? Long-term well-being and happiness in a world where everything's this fluctuating waves that come and go. So it's not built on things, it's not built on getting things, it's built on ways of relating to things. Okay? And so he uses this word, and he says, all things are unsatisfactory. All things are unsatisfactory. And that sounds quite negative to us, because oftentimes we don't know the difference between dissatisfactory and unsatisfactory. Yeah? These are two different words. Right? They're not synonyms. And if we again think about the etymology of things, right? What it means is they are absence of satisfactoriness. They are absent of satisfactoriness. But they're also absent of dissatisfactoriness. Yeah? They are unsatisfactory and they are also undissatisfactory, which doesn't exist as a word, but of course it should. Yeah. So they're unsatisfactory and they're undissatisfactory. No thing can actually make you happy or sad. Yeah? No thing actually does that. We do that in the way that we relate to them. And the way that we relate to them is something that we have some freedom about. And having some freedom about it, we can really generate freedom. So how would it be if we look at something and we say, that is unsatisfactory? It does not contain satisfaction. That's all we're saying, yeah? This is unsatisfactory. It doesn't contain satisfaction. Yeah? This cannot bring peacefulness. Things don't bring peacefulness. Peacefulness rises up in that quietening of demand. This is not peaceful. This does not bring peacefulness. I mean, as we say those words, Oh, yeah. The interesting thing that happens, we say this is unsatisfactory and a certain satisfaction comes into being. Yeah? Interesting. Interesting way of approaching this whole path. Very quick, very immediate thing. There's no negation. It's not like everything is shit and unsatisfactory. It's just unsatisfactory. It does not contain the capacity. Do you know this word? Satis is a feeling of enough. And factory is where things are made. Yeah, this thing cannot make me enough. That whole structure of the self. You notice how it's always like, oh, I'm not enough. I'm not good enough. No one's ever told me I'm good enough. And even when they do, I don't really believe them. Not enoughness, not enoughness, not enoughness, not enoughness. Some people even say it's like the pedal of the bike of the self is just cycling. It's like, oh, I'm not enough, I'm not enough, I'm not enough. No, I'm exhausted and I get to sleep. It's like, I never actually get to, oh, I'll get up tomorrow. Not enough, not enough, not enough, not enough. Nothing is satisfying. Nothing can satisfy that. But when we say it's unsatisfactory, it's really like just getting off the bike, leaning it against the fence, and just having a nice lie down. It's like, oh, phew. My legs are like rubber. I feel so good to rest at last. Yeah. All of this activity of the self, demanding, fixing, getting, removing, it's like it's unsatisfactory. It's unsatisfactory. And then poof. So what, when I do it, leads to my long-term well-being and happiness. So you don't have to figure out how to do this on your own. We're going to guide this into the practice tomorrow. But remembering, many, many dials. So if you have a preferred other dial, preferred came out a bit strange. It's not my original accent, I don't think. So if you have another way of kind of playing with your experience, you can do that. Yeah. But it might turn out that what you really like is just to call it how it is. This thing is unsatisfactory. You let go. And in that letting go, the remarkable thing is it can stay around if it wants to. Because we're not demanding, hey, I called you unsatisfactory, you need to disappear. Yeah, you need to stop bothering me. It's like, no, we're in a different relationship now. You're also welcome through the gates of the Dharma. Yeah. It's wholesome. It's a wholesome comment. This is unsatisfactory. This is not peaceful. The Buddha would say there is a peacefulness possible. There is a peacefulness for you, for all of us possible. But it's not this habitual way we're reacting. Yeah. So let's have a quiet minute together to close out the session. Thank you for your presence, your listening, and your participation in this sharing. And we'll have a bit of time for some walking and then come back for the evening chant.